Welcome back to SIVO Sisters, where we demystify and diversify the field of anesthesiology all within the duration of an anesthesia break. And this week, we are doing something a little different. I have been getting so many questions about what are ways that we as physicians can make our money grow. We're not out here trying to constantly exchange time for money. I was a guest on the Real Estate Mogul MD. And there you will hear about my journey into real estate. I'm not a financial advisor, so please consult a professional if you're interested in learning more. I hope this answers some of your questions as to what I've been doing in the world of real estate. I hope this stirs your imagination in thinking about creative ways to make money while you sleep and to shelter your income from taxes. I will include a link in the show notes for the Real Estate MD podcast for you to check out more. Please enjoy.
That reality hit me actually after I became an attending, which is so weird because here I am a resident and I'm working with my attending and I see that they're on call just like me up at 2 a.m. And for some reason in my head, I thought that that won't be me.
Welcome to the Real Estate Mogul MD podcast. Thanks for tuning in and taking control of your financial future. This is a show where we not only motivate and inspire, we give you actionable, real-world experience to help you live life by design. You'll hear journeys and stories from other physicians, investors, coaches, consultants, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, Brett Riggins. Today, I had an amazing conversation with Dr. Alicia Peterson. She's triple board certified in anesthesiology, pediatric anesthesiology, and pain medicine. And she's now the host of SIVO Sisters podcast, where she speaks about anesthesiology. But I think the most interesting piece of this conversation is Alicia's path. So how she basically crushed a six-figure student loan debt, mitigated, reduced her tax burden, and now is living a happy and fulfilled life, doing what she wants to do when she wants to do it, and having that autonomy that she thought being a doctor would give her. Please welcome Dr. Alicia Peterson to the show. All right, here we go again, and we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Alicia Peterson. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fabulous. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here with you and your listeners. I hope they get value out of our discussion today.
Absolutely. We're going to pull it on out and put it on the table and dive in deep. So tell us all your dirty stories, Alicia. No, I'm just messing with you. We're excited to have you here on the show as well, too. Where are you coming from today?
I reside in D.C. I am from Chicago.
Interesting. So Chicago is cold. I grew up across the lake from there in Southwest Michigan. So I know what that's like in the old windy city there. So now in D.C., Alicia. And tell us a little bit about your medical journey. Where did you start and where you're at now?
Wow. I mean, that's a loaded question. I will say that, I did not grow up with a family of doctors. Okay. Nobody in my household was even in any way connected to medicine. My mom is an engineer, and she wanted to push me into that because there's not that many women in the field. And she enjoyed understanding how things work. The relationship between mother and daughter is pretty complicated. So I naturally rebelled against that. However, I became interested in how things work more on the human side instead of the mechanical side. I grew up a latchkey kid. Both of my parents worked. So I spent a lot of time watching TV, and I grew up watching The Cosby Show, scandal aside, but he was my exposure to the thought of becoming a doctor. And I loved how in that show, it portrayed doctors as being their own bosses, seeing patients in their own time and making a valuable impact. And so I told everyone at that point that I was going to be a doctor, having no exposure really to what the nuts and bolts of that really looked like. And my parents, both of them have master's degrees. Both of them worked, their W-2 jobs, and they spent their money on a bunch of stuff. So we had a grand piano in our house, you know, grandfather clocks, all this expensive carpet, wallpaper, cars. Nothing was saved for my education. Mm-hmm. So when it came to undergrad and announcing that I'm going to be pre-med, it was like, okay, how are we going to pay for this? And my dad emptied his retirement to pay for my first semester of college.
Oh, wow.
And after that, I took on debt and took on more debt to go into medical school. So by the end of the schooling part of it, I had over $300K in debt. Wow. Now, those numbers just felt like fairy dust to me because I'm like, it is what it is. It didn't feel real until I got my first attending job and the government said, you owe us all this money in taxes because I didn't pay a thing throughout school, throughout training, and I deferred all my student loans. And the reality of all of the debt I was in didn't hit me until I started making some decent money. So just going back as far as the medical journey, I went to Loyola Chicago undergrad. I stayed in the Midwest for majority of my education. After Loyola, I took 2 years off. I spent a year at NIH doing like a clinical research internship, looking at DNA. And then I spent a summer in Ghana, again, doing research, analyzing the brain and blood samples of kids who died of severe malarial anemia. And then following that, I came back and I taught fourth graders for a year.
Oh, wow.
And I would argue that teaching fourth graders, that was my first real job, because it was at that moment that I realized that this whole life thing isn't about me. So walking out of college, I had my chest poked out. I'm like, oh yeah, I got this. You know, I study, I know what I'm doing. And it wasn't until I got into that school and those kids were running around in that classroom that I realized, oh my gosh, I don't know anything. And it started this process of me learning how to learn, learning how to teach, and forming relationships with parents, with the kids, with the administrators. And that was the foundation which set me up to be a great physician later in life.
And now, you worked with kids, right? And not only just working with kids, but anesthesiology with children and pediatrics, PEDS, right?
Yeah. Pediatric anesthesia. So I knew I always had a heart for kids throughout college. I volunteered at different community programs. I love the energy they bring. I love their honesty. And yeah, that carried forth throughout my career as a through line. Following teaching fourth graders, that is when I went to Rush Medical College. And Rush has a great relationship with Cook County. Cook County is one of the best county hospitals in the world, in the U.S. particularly too. And it was just fantastic training, working with some of the top physicians around the world coming to Cook County. And it also, I'm working with, you know, people who have really difficult psychosocial conditions, financial means. So I got definitely a well-rounded education at Rush Medical College for sure. Yeah. And then following that, I went to WashU St. Following Rush Medical College, I actually went to SUNY Downstate for pediatric intern year. So many people, when they do intern years, they do it in, you know, internal medicine or surgery. It's not too often you come across a pediatric intern year. But as I was looking for this, because again, I have a heart for kids. And when it comes to the questions or the problems I want to solve, I'd rather get a call about a kid with bronchiolitis than, you know, a 90-year-old who has a urosepsis. And so there's only a few programs in the country that offer pediatric intern years, and I was able to get one in SUNY Downstate. So I lived in Brooklyn for a year, which was absolutely fabulous. They say that everyone should live in New York for a year. I strongly, strongly agree with that. It was just the diversity of people, food, experiences was just top notch. Now, to go from Brooklyn to St. Louis, that was pretty traumatic. Mm-hmm. to go from something where everything is open at all times of day, you can get whatever you want and it's nearby, to the town closes at like 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And there's not the diversity of people and food there. It was very tough.
Yeah.
So throughout residency, that first year was incredibly challenging. Not only the transition from going from Brooklyn to St. Louis, but I also discovered I was pregnant. So I got married the last, after med school graduation. And, you know, when you interview for these residency programs, it's years before, you know, you actually attend there.
Right.
So it wasn't like I could tell the program, oh, when I get here, I'm going to be pregnant. Like, I didn't know. So right. When I show up and I, you know, tell them I'm pregnant, you know, they're taken aback. I'll never forget, my program director looked at me and he was like, did you plan this? And I'm like, no, I did not plan this. Like, this is just what it is.
Yeah.
And so anesthesiology is a very male dominated field and the leadership is very much men. And so to be pregnant in that space made people feel awkward and uncomfortable. And I was already sort of feeling uncomfortable being in a new city in a new program and pregnant. So that first year was one of the biggest challenges for me.
Wow. So when you were, you know, as a child kind of growing up watching Dr. Cosby, right? And that idea of, hey, doctors get to work on their own time and see their own patients. And it seemed all sunshine and rainbows and great. Tell me a little bit about what that felt like when you realized that that's not the way the world worked.
Yeah, amen to that. That reality hit me actually after I became an attending, which is so weird because here I am a resident and I'm working with my attendings and I see that they're on call just like me up at 2 a.m. And for some reason in my head, I thought that that won't be me, even though I'm looking at what my future self would be if I continued on this path. It was just the most oddest thing. I did not think that. And then when I became an attending, that was when oh, your schedule is made for you. You're seeing patients this time and this time. And oh, you need more time for some of these super complex patients? Well, that's on you if you take longer. You know, for cases when they're booked, you know, cases run over all the time. Turnover takes forever. And the schedule might have you think that you're out by 3:30. So you try to make plans. And it's like, nope, not out till 5. So that slapped me in the face because, again, the driver for me to want to be a physician was that appeal of autonomy, having control of my time and being able to be with my family and still contribute. And it was very clear that working the W-2 academic path that I was on and having that autonomy just were not going to sit well together. It just wasn't. Mm-hmm. And it was very hard for me to swallow that pill because I'm like, man, society tells you that this is what you want. You want this W-2 job. You know, you want that security and stability. But then they don't tell you that you're sacrificing your freedom and your autonomy. And that in order to break through, to get the wealth that we all desire. And when I mean wealth, I don't necessarily mean money. I mean having that autonomy to do what you want when you want, you're not going to get that straight W-2 job. It's just not going to happen. And I think that realization was the biggest, it was the hardest pill to swallow, but it was an awakening for me. Just, I was like, man, I don't want to ride this. If I think of cows riding that treadmill, going to the slaughterhouse, I'm like, oh crap, I'm one of these cows. Yeah. Like the slaughterhouse is where dreams go to die. And if I don't get off of this, a part of me is going to die. And I'm going to be one of these walking zombies, you know, complaining about my job, but still feeling like I have to continue on the hamster wheel because I have student loan debt, you know, because I have bills to pay. And it's like, no, I'm controlling the ship.
Yeah. And that idea, you know, that it's life is not a TV show. It's not, you know, we're not going to wake up and be Mr. Bill Cosby there on the Cosby Show, all the other stuff aside, but just on that show alone, it doesn't work like that. And we create these, I heard it called yesterday, the golden handcuff scenario. we're building this machine that's going to kill us. And we need to decide and understand that our health is our wealth. We don't have any wealth without our health. And wealth is not, just like you're saying, is not just money. And the reason why it's not just money is because you need to ask yourself, why? Why do I want this money? What am I going to do with it? Right? And dig deeper and say, when you want your time back, why do you want your time back? What are you going to do with it? Those are the things that are going to make you happy, Alicia. And it's just that same regard where looking back through it, it's again, from the outside, I always tell everybody I'm the outsider looking in on these situations and not necessarily these situations because I live the same thing in my life. Just because I'm not a physician doesn't mean that I don't have those same challenges. I'm a high performance person, which means I give it everything I got and there's my blinders are on and I'm running, I'm gunning. Then when I lift my head up and I look around and nobody's around me, it's like, what happened? Right? This isn't a TV show I thought it was going to be. So I experienced the same thing. We're creating this machine that's going to eat us, whether it's in a partnership, in a practice, in the corporate world as a W-2, that's the conveyor belt you're talking about. And the interesting piece of that too is if we don't take the time to lift our head up and understand the why, the what, the how, what are we doing? Where's the happiness? Lay out some buckets here. I've got a bucket here that I call happiness. I need to fill that bucket. And I don't want any holes in that bucket. The money bucket that we fill, there's a couple ways that we could fill that, also has holes in it. And there's the holes sometimes are caused by that, the thing that you mentioned, W-2, and the taxation piece of that too. So the United States government has loved your parents for the path that they have chosen because they paid their taxes, paid a lot of taxes, and they raised a wonderful young child to put them through the same process and the same kind of conditioning. You get a good job and you work and you save, and that's what you do. So they've paid all these taxes. Now you've paid a lot of taxes in the W-2 world too. So it's just that reoccurring thing, but that's that conveyor belt, you know, that's that conveyor belt of running through. Where does life change for Alicia? Where does that moment, okay, this is not a TV show. What am I going to do? I need to be happy, right? We've got the baby there in residency, which I'm sure was a challenge. And kind of looking up, okay, now I'm earning, my earning power is picked up, but I'm still in this golden handcuff scenario. There's something that fascinating that happens as our income increases, our expenses increase. And there's this lifestyle creep. So you probably have experienced some of that through this journey too. You've got this overwhelming burden of debt on you. Where are we at? Where does that change? Where does that moment happen? Like, okay, this is the path.
Yes. So throughout residency, I didn't have just one baby. I had throughout my training a total of 3 babies, one in the first year of anesthesia residency, one in the last year, and then one during my pain fellowship. So following residency, I did a pediatric anesthesia fellowship and then a pain fellowship. So it was every other year. And what hit me as I became an attending, my first job out of training was I'm discovering that I don't have, you know, this time autonomy. I'm supposed to be a boss and yet I don't feel like it at all. And one of the main things I did was I need to get this debt off of me. Okay. So the 6-figure debt that I'm carrying, and I began looking for other spaces where it's like, okay, how can I get rid of debt? And I came across Dave Ramsey. So, you know, and I'm hearing their stories about, you know, folks who are even in worse financial situations than me. And it was very encouraging. So I didn't do necessarily rice and beans and rice, as he's always talking about eating. However, I did put a significant amount of money on that debt, and I was able to get out of that 6-figure debt in 3 years. So Wow. Yeah, really got
congratulations. Congratulations on the 3 babies and getting out of that debt. So that's awesome.
Thanks. So yeah, it definitely takes a community. And so, you know, the Dave Ramsey community and all of the podcasts that really helped me during that time. The shift came for me though, when it was like, okay, now that I got rid of the student loan debt, whoa, these taxes are crazy. And the audience that Dave Ramsey serves is not necessarily high income earners. So I wasn't getting information as to how can I decrease this tax burden. Now enter in like Leti and Kenji. These are two physicians who looked at real estate and promote real estate as a way of keeping more of what you earn. And learning about, they, at the time that I became familiar with them on their podcast, and they have a course, they really promoted long-term multifamily units, you know, having as many families under one roof for cash flow, you know, because at the time it's like, yeah, I want mailbox money. I want regular cash flow. And I want some of those tax benefits that I can get from real estate, being able to write off those operating expenses and the property management company that we're going to hire and all the repairs and things. And then also too, learning about depreciation and cost segregation. And so look, I'm not a financial expert by any means. I'm not an advisor. But when I think one of the things that I had to come up against as far as a mental roadblock was, as a physician, I was like, man, I learned all the things that I need to learn. Like, I spent years learning. Why I got to learn something else? You know, like, I'm tired of learning new things. I wanted to be able to sit back and just kick back and just coast on what I have learned. And it did take a mindset shift to be like, no, learning doesn't just end in one day. And even though this isn't medicine, I can learn this too. So once I got over that, no, you're going to learn this too. This is very valuable. And then I got upset that why don't we learn stuff like this in medical school? But that's an aside. Learning about like cost segregation and depreciation and ways that we can significantly save on the taxes that are being taken out, taking advantage of what the IRS is providing. Okay. It's not trying to game the system. It's leveraging what is already in place to save on taxes so that we can keep more of what we earn. And that was my first taste of real estate. Listening to Leti and Kenji, I ended up, me and my husband, we bought a quad, which was, a quad is the most doors you can get before stating that this is a commercial property. So we wanted to stay residential. We were able to get financing for that pretty good. We also then ended up getting a triplex and ended up finally also getting a single family home. Now, I know that speaks against the whole multifamily rental thing, but this home looked so good and it was so cheap. I was like, man, I can't let this pass up. So that was what we ended up getting, just long-term renters in multifamilies. And actually, I mean, it did, Leti and Kenji provided like a cash on cash calculator so that we could do our due diligence about the kind of properties we got and, you know, the pricing and the financing and all of that. And we ended up, you know, getting that mailbox money. However, it was okay as far as the amount of money, but it was like, huh, what else do we have to save on taxes, right? Because this is now starting to whet my appetite. Mm-hmm. And my husband started to listen to podcasts as well about this whole topic of real estate. And real estate, there's just so, it's huge, right? Some people think that real estate is just, you're the landlord of like one property and you get calls about like plumbing and stuff. And it's like,
it's my toilet.
Yeah, exactly. That's like the nightmare. That's like a little eyedropper in the huge ocean of what real estate is. So he was looking at, well, why don't we talk about syndication, which is just essentially grouping with a bunch of different investors, pulling in to get, you know, a big property as it is in real estate, but, you know, other things can be syndicated as well. But we were looking at pooling our money together to join other investors because he had formed a relationship with this person who was leading and putting together the syndication deal. And we we did that. And actually, we're still in it because it takes place over the course of like 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the deal is structured, we get most of our distributions like at the end of the deal. So I can't tell you how that investment has gone yet.
Yeah.
But also learning about land easements, conservation easements. I mean, it's, and for those who are like, what the heck is a conservation easement? Basically, you know, we paired with this company who they offer these kinds of deals where land is to be protected, nothing to be built on it. However, when you look at the potential revenue of that land, that is where the worth of that land comes in. And we put in like 25K and was able to write off 100K in taxes because of our tax bracket. And we ended up getting like the tax bracket that we were at was like 35%. And so we were able to get like a 35K tax return in doing like this conservation easement. So that was like another way that significantly decreased our tax burden with the multifamily rentals, with the conservation easement. And then getting back to sort of the renters, short-term rentals was becoming a real big thing. I mean, it still is, but we ended up getting 2 single family homes to do short-term rentals in. One is sort of a beachside coastal home in Norfolk, Virginia, and the other one is more of a rural home in Lexington, Virginia. And it has been really fun, actually, because not only are we, you know, we bought these properties, but we're creating an experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the short-term rental market is more high touch, and it's not just a place for somebody to crash, but it's like curating the kind of experience we want our guests to have. And it was through that that I realized, oh my gosh, I like decorating spaces. I like this curation. And it very much vibes with what I do in medicine, which I'm a pediatric pain physician. And a lot of what we do, a lot of what I do in discussing with patients their care is curating a personalized treatment plan based off of who they are and what they would be willing to do. Because patients come in thinking that medications is all that we have to treat pain, when it's like, actually, that is such a narrow view. We have cognitive techniques. We have physical therapy. We have acupuncture, you know, and we curate a plan. And so short-term rentals, curating an experience, it was in line with what I was doing, just in a different way. So I strongly encourage for anyone who's listening to this, who is afraid of real estate, afraid that they can't learn anything new. It's like, hello, you spent decades proving that you can learn new things and you've done more scarier things, right? Whether that is doing a spinal tap or opening someone up or, you know, counseling someone who's about to die. I mean, if you can do those things, you can do this. And you may find that this is tapping into a part of yourself that medicine just doesn't get to, a more creative part of yourself, maybe a more enterprising part of yourself. And that's what has been incredibly illuminating for me on this journey.
So this, the idea of leveraging the tax code is not taking advantage of it. And a lot of this, you know, we're talking about depreciation, cost seg. Neither of us are CPAs or tax attorneys. So disclosure there. But through our own experience, we can share this. The government gives us pathways to keep more of the money we make by investing in the things that benefit us as a society. Investing in real estate is good. Home ownership is good. And that's why that these benefits are there. It's just like you say, it's not It's not taking advantage of the system. It's using what we're given. And the overwhelming part, and you mentioned, if you can do that, you can do this. The overwhelming part of the tax code is just that. Was it like 13,000 pages or something ridiculous like that? It's like, come on. I don't personally want to know anything about that unless what's going to help me. And what's going to help you is real estate, and investing in these ways that, you know, solar power, gas and oil, car washes, like they all have these means of depreciation. So just understanding the benefits of depreciation, not knowing where or how it comes from and in the ins and outs and how I ought to do this. That's why we work with professionals. But all of this depreciation, is fascinating. We talked about in single family, up to 1 to 4, that's residential. You get 5 and above typically, that's into commercial. You talked about syndications and syndications. You can actually, depending on the deal structure, you can get, the depreciation from the deal there as well too. But the one thing that we haven't talked about yet, Alicia, is that this is all typically going to be passive income, which means we have passive losses can only offset the passive income. You touched on short term. There are some avenues in short term that allow us to get this flag to saying, hey, I'm a real estate professional, and then I can offset my active income, the old W-2 that we've talked about, income, with my passive losses. And then we can accelerate those in the current laws, the way the current laws are. We could accelerate those using a cost segregation analysis to accelerate those depreciations and even hold on to more. The cool thing about syndications too, there's this kind of delayed thing that you can do. It's called a lazy 1031, right? I believe is the term, where you can, the depreciation, if I can't use all my depreciation this year, I can delay it till next year. And you're talking about the syndication you have, if that return of capital is in 5 years, if I could somehow delay this delay all my depreciation until this comes in, then I'm offsetting that. I'm keeping more of the money that I'm making. So there's just some things to throw out there. Say it all is possible. Even if you don't have 100% of your time to devote to real estate, there are still paths and mechanism using the tax code, not taking advantage of it, but using it to your advantage and making sure that you're getting the most out of it as possible. And I think you said it perfectly. You learn by listening to others and watching what others are doing. So if you can do that, you can do this. I think that's going to be my takeaway from this conversation. If you can do a spinal tap, come on. You can do this.
As you know, at Sivo Sisters, we demystify and diversify the field of anesthesiology, all within the duration of a what? Anesthesia break. We're coming up on time. Break is probably over. Join us next week as we continue this thrilling conversation. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Sivo Sisters. If you love this episode as much as I did, head on over and rate and subscribe so you don't miss out. New episodes drop every week on a Monday because we all can use a little something, something to get us through the week. Am I right? I'd love to hear more from you on the topics that you want to hear. So let me know in the comments. This is Dr. Peterson signing off. See you next time.